The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rance, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rance, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
Why aren't the FBI releasing the manifesto from the Nashville mass shooter? Alex Hoff from Fox News will stop by to explain. State Representative Jenny Graham explains how Democrats here in Washington are going even more backward on drug legalization and pursuits. Plus, you will not believe what one teacher put in front of kids for a health course out in Oregon and how it's so bad it's actually going to lead to the recall of the school board. We're going to get to those stories so much more this hour of The Jason Rance Show. So let's dive in.
The monologue.
A bill that the ACLU wanted to pass here in Washington State, it hit a roadblock. It is now dead. Now, it would help limit restraint and isolation of students in schools. That the ACLU is involved is the first major red flag. The second red flag is King 5 is using the Bainbridge Island story that we told you about, what was it, yesterday, the day before? Where a kid was put in a police cruiser to calm down. They're using that as an example as to why this bill might be necessary. And since it's a King 5 story, it's missing some crucial information, like what the bill actually does, which somehow manages not to get put into this story. They simply say it's a bill, quote, focusing on restraint and isolation of students in Washington schools. That's literally all it says about the bill. I am not making that up. They forgot to include in the story what the bill is actually about, what it does. So let's go through it, because I do think that this is one issue that is worthy of revisiting. We've seen some clear abuses by faculty all across the country in which there is a kid who is no doubt acting out, sometimes intentionally just because they're, you know, pain in the backsides. Sometimes they're living with autism, for example. And they've got a staff member who either lacks the patience or lacks the skills to deal with a student like that. And you've seen some significant abuses, like tying someone down into a chair or locking them in a closet or something. So I do think that this is a worthy conversation. Under this bill, it changes the ways, or we'll say it this way, it changes when you should be able, as a teacher, to use physical restraint on a student. And it has to meet all of these standards. The student's behavior poses an imminent likelihood of serious harm to the students or others. Less restrictive interventions would be ineffective in stopping the imminent likelihood of serious harm to the student or to others. The least amount of force necessary is used to protect the student or another person from an imminent likelihood of serious harm. The physical restraint of the student ends immediately upon the cessation of the imminent likelihood of serious harm. That is way too stringent. I don't want it to be the opposite. I don't want it to be too loose. But how do you pose, or how do you prove that the behavior poses an imminent likelihood? How do you prove likelihood? You're going by your gut. You're using your experience, perhaps. But for the most part, you're making a decision that if we don't do something, something bad could happen. Can't prove that there was imminent threat. Can you prove that this was the least amount of force necessary? That to me means you're going to try to de-escalate step by step by step by step and go through everything before you go to the physical restraint. But sometimes the physical restraint is necessary in the moment, and it's not worth testing out less force, a tool that is less forceful before you go and pull the trigger there. Now, they also limit the isolation of students in various, they call them isolation rooms, but again, it could be a car even. They say staff may use isolation on a student who is in grade 3 through 12 only when the same requirements that I just said for the physical restrictions are met. Same thing. That just seems a little bit too stringent. I would rather us focus on getting teachers better training to deal with students who act out again, there's no doubt that there are some teachers who abuse these kids and they don't know how to deal with it. But there are also a lot of teachers who are overworked. You've given them a large classroom and you've got a kid who is acting out. You're putting the teacher in a position where they might end up using restraint only so that they can get on with their day and teach the other kids in the classroom. And that's not necessarily fair to the kid. So then put more money into the schools if you think that that's what is necessary on a district-by-district basis. I just don't like the idea of telling a teacher who's in a position that some lawmaker in Olympia is not going to have an easy time understanding unless they were previously a teacher. You're telling them that you know better than they do in the moment that they're in, that you're not. That 2 months from now, after you pass a bill, that you know better than the teacher, who presumably you will give training to, on how to deal with one of these kids. Now, the part to me that just pushed me over the edge and saying, yeah, this is the wrong bill, ironically had nothing to do with the content of the bill. But it had to do with data that was collected that King 5 reported on. It said almost 25,000 incidents against approximately 3,000 students in a year resulted in some kind of restraint. We found that restraint and isolation are used disproportionately against students who are in kindergarten through grade 5, students who are Black and multiracial, and students who are unhoused. Which, again, disproportionality arguments are the laziest anyone can make. Are you telling me that those kids were not misbehaving to the point where restraint might have been necessary? Or simply that it just so happened to be during the data that you looked at during the time period that more kids who are kindergarten through grade 5, students who happen to be Black, or students who happen to be unhoused, were acting out in a way that required some sort of physical restraint? They don't answer that. They simply try to imply that it's all due to some sort of institutionalized bigotry or bias. And I reject that the same way I reject this bill.
The interview.
As I said last night on Fox News at Night, traditionally, when there is a manifesto after a very high-profile crime, it's released relatively quickly. There are some reasons why you might not release it that are legitimate, but I can't think of any in the case of the Nashville shooter. Joining me on the line to discuss is our friend from Fox News, Alex Hoff. Welcome back.
Hey, Jason. So good to be with you.
Now, if there was a second person possibly tied to a future crime and it happened to be mentioned in the manifesto, that would be a legitimate reason to hold it back. But that's obviously not the case here. What do you think is going on? Why the reluctance to release it?
I think it might come down to the contents of this manifesto. My personal thought might be, as this is being combed over in a profiling sense, trying to get a better idea of the motivations behind this shooter, Audrey Hale, that the authorities would be looking, could there be something in here that could then spark others? Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I can imagine a fear would be, especially in a case like this, where so many sides have been taken, so much sympathy, I mean, in a way I haven't seen before, has been given to a shooter.
Yeah.
You don't want these words to be used as a call to action. So that's what I think it might come down to. Will anything be redacted? And what can we use to try to create a mold for this kind of shooter? Because the biological gender alone, it does make Audrey an anomaly.
100%. And that's, you know, the tragedy aside, when we look at profiling shooters, they traditionally are young males. You know, 28 is relatively young, but a little bit older than what we've seen for school shootings.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's a biological woman here who also happens to be transgender male, it is a wrinkle in the traditional characteristics that we ascribe to potential shooters.
Yes. And I think it's something that I've thought a lot about for many years, because in having conversation, I was actually talking to my husband, and my husband said, you know, this is being very frank. He said, I don't care what this person wanted to be called. I don't care anything about them. Like, we have to focus on the victim. He's completely right. But I countered him. I'm like, I do care when it can come to prevention. So mm-hmm. I think part of this, there are parts of this shooter that I think actually do ring true in this symptomatic characteristics that we can see in other mass, very public shooting settings. That is having a recent event that may have been emotionally troubling. Another thing is a fear of rejection or history of rejection in perceptive or potential romantic partners and isolation, certain interests. So there are some things that I think actually do put this shooter, Audrey, into a box that we've seen in the past. And if you're somebody who perhaps is trying to prove to those around you in your community, hey, yes, I am a male on the inside, with whatever that might mean to a person, maybe you say, okay, let me do something that young men do. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. in some cases, this may be it.
Yeah, and part of me wonders if there's a fear ahead of this newly rebranded Trans Day of Vengeance that's supposed to happen tomorrow through the weekend. It might inspire violence either from the group or towards the group, depending again on what's in this manifesto. But I mean, the idea that activists are moving forward with a day of vengeance after this is just so tasteless, and it's alarming.
It is. And I this might be a time to look back and look at the word, the term literally. We've seen that on social media everywhere, literal violence towards the trans community, or yep. literal violence towards Christians, or that we have to start realizing that these things have not been literal. And
exactly.
except for in this case in Nashville, 6 lives were lost. That's literal violence. We need to start talking in very practical terms about these things. And if when you're trying to sell a movement as being life and death or genocide and expanding the term genocide, mm-hmm. it really riles people up. If we can have an honest conversation, not using hyperbole, I think all sides of every issue would benefit. In this case, there should be no sides.
100%. And it was funny because I made a very similar comment on Tucker Carlson this week. And of course, I get ripped by folks on the far left who want to pretend that there is this threat that we're headed towards Nazi Germany, towards transgender folks. And, you know, if this was a shooter with a MAGA hat on, the immediate framing from the media would be around the rhetoric coming from Donald Trump and from Fox News and from conservatives yeah. about how it's inspiring this kind of violence. And yet at the same time, no conversation whatsoever about the point you just made, which is pretending that or conflating a criticism or support of a policy is the same as physical violence towards someone and actually poses a physical threat to their existence. That might also inspire some of this conduct.
To a vulnerable mind, if someone is saying those phrases we've seen since 2016, come alive, the silence is violence, those things, that does not equal that. And if we can just, but you have to then understand, like, if you are a vulnerable person yep. and someone's telling you the group that you claim to belong to is going to be carted away and burned alive, I mean, you are a person who are going to feel, oh my gosh, this is a call to arms for me. So there are those to blame in every scenario where extremism comes to fruition, that they know that they yeah. fuel the fire with false coals.
And again, folks, it's not about not having discussions of substance and offering criticisms. You can certainly do that. It's just stop lying about what's going on yeah. and using that sort of extremist rhetoric, and both sides can do it, but it seems like only one side gets called out. The other side is praised as heroic for taking those positions. And I don't know if that played a role here. Certainly we'll find out once we get this manifesto. We've been talking with Alex Hoff from Fox News. Thank you so much as always. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Jason.
Now this.
The interview.
Well, if you were expecting Democrats in Olympia to fix the gun pursuit bill or the effective legalization of drugs, not only were you mistaken, you underestimated how much worse they could make it. We're going backwards. Joining me on the line to discuss is State Representative Jenny Graham, Republican from Spokane. Welcome back to the show.
Jason, it's a pleasure to be here today.
I appreciate that, though I know it's not a pleasure to have to give us some bad news as it relates to those two issues I brought up. Let's start with drug legalization. We know that if there isn't a bill that's passed to address the felony possession ruling, that all drugs are effectively legalized on July 1st. So it sounds like Democrats are going in the opposite direction. They're just leaning into more legalization.
Well, you're right. You are right about that, which is, you know, it's very concerning, obviously. And I think, honestly, what I'm seeing here at the legislature is, first, whether you're Republican or Democrat or you're somewhere in between, we all have families that we love. And the substance abuse issue is not a Democrat issue. It's a bipartisan issue. There are members' families that are dealing with that unfortunate issue right now. And I think where we're seeming to butt heads a little bit more is there are members that don't want there to be any sort of bills passed that force somebody to go into treatment. And then you have those of us that are saying, you know, if you are, especially if you're committing crimes, we have to stop the revolving door where somebody can say, okay, I'm going to go for treatment, and then they just turn around and leave. And there's no requirement for them to complete it. And as their crimes continue to grow, we must step in and take a hard stand. And in the legislature, Representative Goodman more than once has mentioned, you know, that we are pursuing the Norway's policy for how they handle crime. Mm-hmm. So this is being done without a vote of the people, you know, to just move us to that. And the other thing that I pointed out during that committee hearing was that in Norway, you're not allowed to drink in public. You're not allowed to do drugs in public. And if you have a substance abuse issue, they absolutely can and do make you take medicine or go into treatment. So
I think, State Representative, that this is a situation where the media is just not doing its job, because if people realize what the Democrats are doing here and what effectively they're saying no to, there would be pushback. For example, one of the changes made to the bill was limiting when a prosecuting attorney could actually say, okay, we're going to move forward. I know that this drug user, this addict is in a pretrial diversion drug program, but they're very clearly not even showing up. I'd like to move forward and put this person in jail. They took that out. They took out a 21-day mandatory minimum sentence for folks who were convicted of only certain drug offenses who refuse to go into the treatment that is a condition of their probation. We are literally telling people, at all consequence for breaking the law.
Right. And, you know, I think that part of what it is, again, you know, that we're seeing is, you know, and I did point out, I grew up in Washington State in Federal Way in Auburn, and things were very definitely different regarding crime and drugs. Our policies were different at that point. And we even talked about the DARE program. You know, there are people that keep saying, oh, it doesn't work. It didn't work. Well, I watched it work. And I'm going to point to the fact, look at what happened when we were teaching kids about the dangers of drugs and what this could possibly lead to in your lives. Look at those numbers versus now, when we have literally thousands of people dying from, you know, substance abuse, overdosing. And, you know, we have the Narcan now, too. So on multiple times, somebody can overdose and end up getting Narcan. Those people need treatment. And with State v. Blake, they put this into play. And the bottom line is, we are not seeing a whole bunch of people that are moving towards treatment. It's just the opposite. There are very few that are seeking treatment.
I can write the script on all the numbers of fatal overdose deaths in the upcoming year and next year just by their lack of action. They are literally killing people in this case. Finally, let's just switch gears. We only have a few minutes left to talk about the vehicular pursuit ban. There was hope that there was bipartisan support to rescind the ban, and then we got a watered-down version that made its way out of the Senate. Where do things stand right now? Because it seems like nothing significant is going to change.
Right. And so for both of those bills, I voted no. They were protest votes. And the bottom line is, again, there was another one of the amendments that I had that ended up getting scoped. And I pointed out that if somebody's driving 111 miles an hour down the road, that should be reckless driving, not speeding. And they should be able to pursue and stop that person from hurting somebody. Same thing if they're going the opposite way on a roadway. We're seeing people that are getting murdered. And I think probably one of the most painful things that I saw was the Gildaid family sitting in the front row of our committee when we were taking that vote. And they, and I agree, there have been some people that have been killed, you know, in the police pursuits. But there are people that are being killed, like Immaculée, her, their daughter, and there's no justice for them. And so I rightfully talked about the fact that the victims don't get to choose what positions they're in where they end up getting hurt or killed. But when an officer is telling somebody to pull over and they decide not to pull over, that is a choice they are making. And we, when they don't pull over, and especially if somebody is hurt or killed, we need to throw the book at them for that. We mean it when we say pull over, because they put themselves in danger, everybody around them, our police. We should not be tolerating this under any circumstances, not to mention how many people's cars are being stolen and damaged on the roads. And I talked about that, too.
Yeah, when they do don't care. Having, Democrats don't care.
When do we start having compassion for our families and our businesses and our communities? The people that are on fixed incomes, young people, disabled people that can't just afford to go out and buy a new car, you know, that matters. And I've got pretty riled up and pretty passionate about that.
You're supposed to. The fact of the matter is, the problem is not your passion. It's a lack of passion coming from the Democrats. I hope you'll continue to put pressure on them. I hope people listening will take this as an opportunity to write or call their state representative to make sure they know that you're following their inaction on these bills. State Representative Jenny Graham, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
Of course. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
The city of Seattle and the Seattle Police Department, they are ready to move on from the federal consent decree. What exactly does that mean? Joining me on the line is the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Officer Mike Solon. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jason, for having me on.
So getting rid of the consent decree is not a new concept, because prior to the death of George Floyd, the city of Seattle was all on board, saying that the department is clearly ready to move on. Politics got in the way. Do you anticipate this being rewarded or granted?
I do, but there's going to be a couple catch points on it, where they're going to have what it appears to be a proposal for the federal judge to consider in terms of continued oversight, albeit on a smaller scale, relative to use of force and the conversation about crowd control tactics, and then obviously the never-ending conversation about accountability.
Do you think that's necessary from the union position?
Well, we would like the – well, here, let me back up. Jason, DOJ can stick around here for however long they want. We really don't care. We are proud of the fact that collectively we've done the hard work to get us into reform. 3 years ago, to your point from just a few minutes ago, and then obviously in today's conversation. So they can stick around here as long as we want. It doesn't really impact us. In fact, it was DOJ, the fact that they were still here during the summer of 2020, is the reason why we were able to still use crowd control tactics and save this city, let alone losing another precinct to utter chaos and domestic terrorists that were assaulting police officers and conducting property damage.
Yep. So, yeah, know, just because, just very quickly, the context of that is that the council, and at the time the mayor, they were the ones getting in the way of the police department using non-lethal tools to help during riots that were being defended by certain council members.
Correct. And they were trying to remove the ability for people to, officers, to use less lethal tools to save lives. And to us, that was absolutely egregious, so naive and backward thinking that it was appalling and still is to this day.
Yeah.
So, and to my point earlier, you know, we've lost, you know, a countless amount of people since 2020. But more importantly, during those riots, we had, you know, hundreds of officers injured, many of them with career-ending injuries. And still, there's been no acknowledgement to the officers that were hurt publicly by elected officials and or condemning the actions of the criminals.
And you're not going to get
people. That. So, yeah, and I digress. We'll never get it. So in terms of, you know, I think your question was, is it necessary to keep them here? Look, if you want to continue to have the conversation about accountability, then we welcome it. You know, we're the most accountable agency in the United States of America in terms of policing, bar none. I'll debate that with anybody, and we will win. But you know what? If we want to hold us to another standard of accountability, then come to the table and we'll talk about it. And it's a working condition issue, and we'll bargain it at the table. But we're proud of the fact that we're accountable and we're highly professional. And we'll compare ourselves up to any police agency in this nation in terms of police officers taking account for their actions, which we deem more often than not are professional.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Officer Mike Solon of the Seattle Police Officers Guild. The consent decree might be removed with some caveats, as he mentioned. I will say one reason why you should want it to go completely is the fact that whenever there's a consent decree, it's an easy excuse for anti-cop activists to point to and say, here's proof that they haven't actually reformed. If they're reformed, why is there still a consent decree? You've heard that before.
Oh, of course I've heard it before, and I just covered this on my podcast, Hold the Line with Mike Solon, with our guest, Bob Scales, who, as you know, served this city for years, was intimately involved in the Department of Justice settlement agreement with DOJ and the city of Seattle. And to Bob's point, I'm not going to speak for him. People can go to the podcast and check it out. This is any type of you have DOJ come in for a settlement agreement or a consent decree, same thing. It's all politics.
Yeah.
Period. And, you know, I think the city of Seattle projected that DOJ's budget in terms of its impact on the Seattle constituents, the tax base, would be roughly $60 million. Well, we're north of $200 million with no end in sight.
Mm-hmm.
So people do the math and then look at all the consent decrees across the nation and their uptick. This is clearly about politics. And, you know, if we were the modeled reformed agency for others to emulate 3 years ago, then why are we still having the conversation today about DOJ now advocating to leave, albeit holding back two pillars of continued oversight?
There's a piece over at Como News indicating that, according to the mayor's office, the department has lost 400 officers since 2019. That is verifiably false. It's definitely more than 400. But they're saying now they're seeing fewer departures than they have in the past, and they're seeing an increase in applications. Increase in applications doesn't necessarily mean anything if they're not qualified. But where does everything stand from your perspective as it relates to recruitment and retention?
Well, I would say that retention is the number one issue that impacts this job on a day-to-day conversation with the officers that work for the city. And the only way that they can retain the current professional police officers from continuing to flee is to provide us a fair and competitive labor contract, bar none. We're 2 years, 4 months into an expired contract. And on average, Jason, for your listeners to understand, the police department and the city of Seattle, in terms of the SPOG labor contract conversation, is historically working under an expired contract for 3 to 4 years. Right now, we're at 2 years and 4 months. And given we've lost close to 600 cops in 3 years, and that we're still at the bargaining table, which is positive, but we're not quite there in terms of getting a contract. I think it speaks volumes in terms of, you know, the politics still being inserted in the public safety political discourse here.
Do you have any idea where that 400 number came from?
No idea.
What are they talking about?
I have no idea. I mean, I responded to the people that sent me that. I was like, this is utterly fake news. In fact, I even emailed that reporter yesterday to just clarify how they got those numbers. And of course, I didn't get a response. And so for me, when that information is put out, what appeared to be complete fabricated information, that's a concern. And the reality is we've lost roughly since 2020, 551 officers and counting.
Yeah.
We're projecting to lose about 147 this year alone. And the recruitment side of the house, they're not getting the numbers that they've initially wanted. And the bigger concern is we're worried about them lessening the standards to get hired. And then once they pass all their rigorous training, hopefully that doesn't get degraded just to get a body in a uniform. And then when they get out to the street, do they have the skill set, the acumen to be a professional police officer, to serve?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a major concern for us. I mean, look what happened in Memphis when you ease background for human beings trying to be police officers. When you don't have those robust backstops to prevent people who are unqualified becoming a police officer, that's what you end up dealing with.
But what are some of the specifics that have been held back? One of the issues I perceived, and you and I have spoken about this in the past, is that because of the activism within the sort of anti-police movement, I imagine you're going to get certain kinds of applicants who are still activists and they hope to, you know, change the system from within when they get hired, and they're not necessarily cut out to be a cop. They're just doing it for, you know, political change, and their intentions might be well and good, but that could put people at risk, including the individual.
Yeah, I would say that that's accurate, but you know what? I welcome any type of individual who wants to become a police officer to fulfill whatever mindset or ideology that they're coming from. The reason why I say that is so they can get informed. Mm-hmm. So they can actually understand what the job entails, what it takes to be a cop, the pressures, the politics behind it, the reality of serving as a public safety officer. And hopefully those people stick around and they actually see that, you know what, cops are actually really good people. They're not perfect, but what I've been told earlier, meaning I'm just putting myself into that activist mindset, doesn't really conform to what I was told. This is a different reality. And maybe then we can start to shift the cultural, societal mindset from the activist groups that are saying that this system is racist in general. So I welcome any activist to apply.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always said that.
Oh, no, you have been consistent on that. Has the SPD lowered their standards?
Not that I'm told. Not that I've seen, Jason. But it's my understanding that the talent pool, the candidate pool, is now not only just localized as far as it being difficult to find a quality human being, but it's a nationwide problem.
Yeah,
I'm involved with, you know, groups of, you know, police associations and unions across the nation, and in conversation with those people on a regular basis. And this recruiting problem is not just localized to Seattle; it's nationwide. It's a serious, serious societal public safety dilemma we find ourselves in post 2020, and the incessant drive to what would you call it? The painting of the law enforcement profession as being the problem and as being racist in general, to me, is what's driven a lot of the detractors to successfully push people away from this profession, where it's extremely difficult to find quality people to do the job anymore. And that, to me, is concerning on a public safety conversation, because who's going to be there to help our communities get through criminals who are treating them in a poor way and creating more victims?
Officer Mike Solon is the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild. He's also host of the podcast Hold the Line. You can subscribe wherever it is you get your podcast. Go directly to HoldTheLineWithMikeSolon.com. Become a podcast subscriber. You'll get some really good information. Mike, appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason, for what you're doing, man.
Thank
you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rants. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So there's a story out of Oregon that is probably equal parts disturbing, but also inspiring, if that makes sense. Because parents decided to push back on something they should have pushed back on. And it tells you, it shows you what it's like, what it means to be more engaged in the community, to say, yeah, we're not okay with this. In this case, you got a bunch of parents who are now looking to replace the entire school board because of an incident that happened at one of the schools concerning curriculum that was pursued by a teacher that included a sexually explicit book. On top of that, they say there were at least two instances where the teacher organized activities to discuss sexual acts. Now, the story comes to us from Fox News, Fox News Digital. This was really a follow-up to a story out of Eugene, Oregon at Churchill High School, where students were asked, and these are health students in high school, they were asked to complete a 10-point assignment titled Fantasy Story. Okay? Fantasy Story. Now, according to the curriculum, it read, "For those students who were absent, you will write a short story of a paragraph or two. This story is a sexual fantasy that will have no penetration of any kind or oral sex, no way of passing an STI." Now, the teacher, Kirk Miller, asked students to choose three items, such as candles, massage oil, feathers, and flavored syrup, to use in the story, that according to Fox News. And they've got a screenshot of the specific curriculum prompt. Let's call it a prompt because you're supposed to be writing an essay. Oh, my gosh. It says, "Your story should show that you can show and receive loving physical affection without having sex." So that is obviously true, but should you be telling your 10th grade kids to put together a sex fantasy, even without the actual sex? A parent by the name of Justin McCall said his older daughter showed him the assignment and said that the teacher had asked students to pick the sexual items written on the piece of paper out of a hat that he passed around the class. Oh my gosh. Now, the name of the class is Health to Human Sexuality. And after there was some kind of, I don't know if it was an official investigation, but just they're calling further scrutiny of the course, found that students were also allegedly given an assignment called With Whom Would You Do It? The project involved a virtual spinning wheel labeled with sexual categories. Students were allegedly instructed to respond when the wheel stopped and write the initials of the person that they would engage in the sex act with. Oh my God. Now I'm going to read a comment made by the teacher that is somewhat graphic if you're a child. You probably don't want your kid hearing this, but there's nothing, you know, there's no bad words or anything. But I do think it's important to hear specifically what was allegedly being put in front of kids. The father that we told you about, Justin McCall, said, quote, "My daughter told me it was literally up on the board and it mentioned, you know, who you going to have anal penetration with, oral sex, licking of the ear, kissing, and vaginal sex. He called it disgusting and wrong." And I think that is an understatement. It very clearly is wrong. I wonder if this is a teacher who thinks he has to be cool and edgy in order to get kids to pay attention in health class. And I suppose, you know, it's laudable to want people, kids, to pay attention in your class. This is not it. And it shows a remarkable lack of judgment. Remarkable lack of judgment. And so after the parents complained to the school board, they don't think the school board did enough to assuage their concerns to handle this particular incident. And so now, as a result, you've got parents saying, you know what, we're done. We don't want the school board representing us anymore. They don't have what's in the best interest for the kids in mind. Now, whether or not they mishandled is obviously up to the parents. It sounds like at least one who is not just a parent, but he decided he's going to step up and actually run for the school board. Some of this is subjective. His name is Michael Bratlin, but I think he does offer some interesting observations, at least from the parents' perspective.
As a parent, we think that nobody wants to take accountability for this. And I think it would be nice for leaders of the board to say, listen, we're going to take accountability for this, even though we can't actually read every assignment. We don't know what every assignment is. But once we saw this, we took immediate action. And I think immediate action, it was correct. I think they waited a little bit too long, maybe, but the teacher is not teaching right now. He's on leave. But there needed to be a good investigation. And they weren't super clear with us or straightforward with us at first. I think the first response the school board had was, hey, parents had the right as of January to opt out of this curriculum. Well, if you would have presented that to the teachers as an example, hey, this is an example of the essay assignments that we're going to give your child, most of the parents, even the people on the left, would have said, no, that's inappropriate. I'm not going to agree to that.
Yeah. These are some of those issues that, even though the framing in the media makes it seem like it's conservatives versus liberals, that it's these conservative parents who don't want their kids learning about gender identity because they're all bigots, that framing is disingenuous, as you know. These are pretty simple issues that, regardless of one's political perspective, can say, this is wrong, this is inappropriate. And I think, especially when it comes to parents dealing with either teachers or school board members, they give a lot of room for errors. Not when it comes to the safety of their kids, but when it comes to just questionable judgment. I think there is a benefit of the doubt given because, you know, you trust these adults. You've given them control of your kids for many hours of the day, and you know that they are teaching them what they need to learn in order to be successful in the community, in the real world. But at some point, they go too far. And understand that when you're at the point where you're going after a teacher's job or you're going after the job of a school board, realize that that has been a long time coming. It's been issues that have been simmering for a while. And only now are they finally pushed to the brink. And I'm glad they're doing something. I'm glad they're doing something here. Parents don't have to cede so much power to the left. And again, on this case, in most of these cases, when dealing with schools, the left and the right are on the exact same page. The media coverage of it is not. They go after the conservatives here and they misconstrue. But parents of all political stripes, yeah, they just want what's best for their kid. 1-800-465-8770 for your texts.